Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayen Dengbior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Wednesday, November 20th, 2019. Another SPLM resignation. And human rights groups call on South Sudan to commute a death sentence. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A longtime member of the ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement tendered his resignation to the President Salva Kiir this week. Walla Tuck says he resigned from the SPLM because he does not want to be associated with a party that has brought conflict and suffering to South Sudanese people. He says the ruling party has failed to achieve its mission.
The leadership thought that I was a renegade that should be punished. He said that the president about the people from Warabi State and my fellow Dinkerman who have not yet gone against the system. And the example was to be set with me, but miraculously, in one way or another, I escaped the grasp. And I came to this country where I live my sort of asylum.
Your critics would say you have a second home now, you've been resettled in New Zealand. Why are you still possessed with South Sudan?
I love South Sudan, I love the people of South Sudan, and they deserve the best that they're not getting, and I know they should get. And if I keep quiet, what is the purpose of me having the opportunity that I had to be able to identify the issues and be able to be in touch and live like many of my peers are not living with me? Take, for example, we don't have among us now Samuel Dong. They were raising the same issues that I'm raising, despite that they were in a different political party. We need our country to move forward.
Someone still would challenge you and say, you are talking from thousands of miles away. Why are you not in Juba to fight inside? Just like what your colleagues in the parliament are doing right now, demanding for the resignation of the speaker and calling for reforms within the parliament.
Being far does not mean that the people of South Sudan will not hear what I say, or the regime will not understand or feel the impact of what the people of South Sudan doing collectively.
Some of you, when you are inside the party, you praise Salva Kiir, you call him all the nice names, but when you leave Juba, you start pointing fingers at him that he is a dictator, he has messed the country, but you were in the same government. He appointed you as a member of parliament. Didn't you know that this was the same person that you're calling him names now?
I will not speak for the people, I'll speak for myself. I stood for the interests of the people, I did not stand for the interests of the individuals in the government. That said, when you enter into a system, there's always a process. For example, before you fall out with a person, there has to be a contact point, and the contact point is for you to accept the appointment where you will be able to be close to the power and be able to implement things as they are. But it has come to a point, I believe, it cannot be changed. Reform to be reformed.
It's my understanding that you have been a member of the SPLM, you lived in the SPLM-controlled areas during the war, you know, SPLM in and out. Why are you abandoning the party that brought you up politically?
The SPLM was founded under the principle of justice, of equality and prosperous country. But you see today, that doctrine doesn't exist. It exists only in the papers that are in the shelves, and the actions of individuals in the party are absolutely opposite and in conflict with the values that our people fought for. The SPLM I was in was fighting for the values I just mentioned. But when they depart from it, I felt it would be best interest of the country, of myself, and of the SPLM to take it to the next level. And to the next level is to resign, and I believe the chairman, Salva Kiir, and his group would listen that the people of South Sudan are not comfortable with the way they are running the country, and now that I'm stepping out, other people may do the same thing, and they may have a change of heart. And if that happened, then I have rescued the SPLM, I've rescued the people of South Sudan, and the prosperous come.
Walla Tuck, politics is a game. In fact, there are people who say they don't believe politicians because politicians say something today, tomorrow they will change. or they will turn around and blame the media for exposing them. Why should people believe you?
I'm not every politician. I'm a different politician.
But politics is politics. Politics is politics.
Politics is politics when the dishonest men are running it, but when the honest people are in, and then it's something else. People who value their own worth, who value their own integrity, who value the future of the country, will not turn around and do something like running into it. I have resigned from the government. I had the comfort. I had the resources. I had the protection of the government. If I had cooperated and supported the value they had. But I chose to sacrifice not only my positions. I sacrificed my livelihood that were outside of the government. I believe in the principle the people of South Sudan collectively fought for.
That's Wol Attaq, former SPLM lawmaker who resigned from the ruling party this week. He was speaking via WhatsApp with my colleague John Tanza earlier today from Wellington, New Zealand. Some activists inside and outside South Sudan are asking President Salva Kiir to commute the death sentence of a 17-year-old death row convict arrested in 2007 for accidentally killing his cousin during a fight. This week, Amnesty International called on the public to write petitions to President Kiir to commute the boy's sentence. Winnie Torino reports from 4VOA from Juba.
Emmanuel Malwal, a journalist covering human rights issues for Sayare TV and radio in Kenya, is also urging the government to free 17-year-old Magai Matiop. Malwal says Magai was unfairly sentenced to death because he was denied a lawyer during his court hearing, and says since Magai told the court his cousin's death was an accident, the community should decide his fate.
I'm calling also the government to revisit his case and set him free because he's underage and he's supposed to be in what we call a juvenile facility, not the main prison that he was spending his time. So we support to did it culturally because according to Dinka culture, they have a way of solving it. They have blood confrontation. Blood confrontation is defined with the nature of crime. Well, both parties supposed to sit down and agree on a certain point.
Rach Malwal, a human rights lawyer with the Screen of Rights Group, says the responsibility of criminal matters depends on the age of the accused. He says children below the age of 18 have some exceptions in relation to some of the criminal punishments.
You cannot, for example, give a maximum sentence for a case of murder committed by a child under age or who has not yet attained the age of majority, meaning the age of 18. They are assumed not to be having, a capacity of thinking and knowing legally what they should do. For example, taking the responsibility with respect to killing a person by a child can be different when an older age person decides. And so it is not really right that the court has sentenced this child to death.
Malal says the government should consider Magai to be reformed since the main reason of sentencing a person to prison is to deter future criminal cases. Rach is urging Magai's new lawyer to petition the Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court as a path towards setting Magai free. Saif Magango, Deputy Director of Amnesty International for East Africa, the Horn and the Great Lakes, says Magai was only 15 years old when he fought with a neighbor. He says when Magai's cousin tried to stop the fight, Magai took his father's gun and fired warning shots to the ground, in which one bullet bounced off the ground and hit his cousin, who later died in hospital. Magango says Magai's sentence violates both South Sudan law and international law. He calls on everyone to join millions of Amnesty International members worldwide in writing letters to President Salva Kiir to commute Magai's death sentence.
It is just a call on the general public to join us in this campaign and write as many petitions to save Ngong's life, but also to call on South Sudan's government to reconsider this cruel punishment and commute Magai's sentence, as well as really reflect on whether they need to keep the death penalty as a form of punishment. What we recommend is that they take measures to impose a moratorium in the first sentence, and if they cannot go straight away, and abolish this penalty right away. That would be the ultimate objective, because death penalty is outdated and cruel punishment in this year and age.
Maganga says the use of the death penalty against children is strictly prohibited by Section 21, Subsection 2 of South Sudan's Transitional Constitution and under the International Human Rights Law, specifically Article 37A of the Convention on the Rights of Children, to which South Sudan is a party. South Sudan in Focus contacted Justice Minister Paulino Wanawila, who declined to comment, saying, "Please stop this kind of thing. I do not need to answer other people's concerns." He then hung up the phone. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
Sudanese Finance Minister Ibrahim al-Badawi says the country needs $5 billion to avoid economic collapse. Since late 2017, Sudan has suffered a currency and fiscal crisis that has led to hyperinflation, a collapse of the banking system, and shortages of basic goods such as fuel. Sudan has no access to funds from the international financial institutions. During Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok's visit to Brussels last week, he asked the EU to push for Sudan's removal from the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism to facilitate international lending to his country. Paul Nyantulia, a research associate at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about the need to combine economic reform in Sudan with political democratization.
I think it's imperative that the new administration should not limit its reform agenda merely to economic reform and to getting outside economic assistance. As important as that is, they should not lose sight of the need for democratic and constitutional reforms as demanded by the Sudanese people. If they minimize this process simply to securing assistance from outside, while retaining the authoritarian structures that Sudan has had since independence, it's a model that hasn't worked. It hasn't worked in other situations such as South Sudan, Zimbabwe, and Democratic Republic of Congo. So I think the best way out is not to lose sight of the democratization agenda.
What can the international community offer Sudan to counter its challenges?
I think what the international community needs to is to support, enable, and assist the larger democratization process in Sudan. It's important to remember that Sudan's economic are rooted in what was essentially an authoritarian system that damaged the country's institutions, militarized the country, looted the country's resources and public assets. And because there was lack of accountability and parliament and all these independent institutions were not working, the economic planning was arbitrary. It was characterized by patronage and serious financial and fiscal misconduct. So the international community should not just be content in merely extending aid and assistance just because Bashir is gone. And we've seen that this new government, it has goodwill, but we all understand that it faces monumental challenges moving forward. And many in the new setup would like to retain as much of the old system as they can. These are very powerful individuals. And so this is a fragile transition. So international partners should understand that their support must be premised on pushing forward on the democratic front.
Government spends 60-70% of its budget on defense and security. Placing new limits on these forces should also be an economic priority. However, Prime Minister Hamdok hinted that spending would only be redirected away from defense and security when the government has reached a peace agreement with armed groups from the Blue Nile, Darfur, and South Kordofan provinces. What do you make of that?
This should tell us immediately that the military component of the transitional government still holds tremendous political power. Within that component, the most powerful faction, certainly in the minds of many Sudanese, is still loyal to the commander of the Rapid Response Forces, General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, also known as Hemeti. Many believe that he continues to wield significant influence behind the scenes. But this should not be surprising. Post-transitional contexts, from authoritarian systems to democracy, are notoriously very, very difficult, with members of the old order trying to preserve as much of it as they can. So we can be sure that elements of the old security establishment might not be too pleased with the Prime Minister's decision to open negotiations with all of Sudan's rebel groups. It is worth noting that Sudan's defense and security budget and its intelligence budget were routinely abused and used as part of Bashir's extensive patronage network. So reaching peace with the rebels and reducing the defense budget might shake up and weaken those networks. It's always a danger, and it's one that the Prime Minister must be keenly aware of.
Sudan has also asked the European Union to push for its removal from the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism. How would that move facilitate international lending to Sudan?
What is required in the Sudan is a social and political transformation that places the country on a democratic footing. Sudan is certainly facing economic challenges. It is certainly facing financial challenges. But I think the most important thing is to reform the country's institutions. Because if outside assistance comes in into an authoritarian environment, an environment that is rife with impunity and with misconduct, then even that aid will not help ultimately at the end of the day. Financial assistance, yes, it's extremely important from regional sources, from international sources, from the private sector, extremely important. But the actors must remember that this assistance must be anchored in a vision of constitutionalism, in a vision of restoring the rule of law, and a vision of putting Sudan back on a democratic path.
That is Paul Nyantulya, a research associate at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA's Mohamed Alshanawi. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A new study points to an alarming decline in the quality of education in Uganda. More on that when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you agree with the way a society assigns roles to men and women?
Mostly it's men that do the work, but also women are also given responsibilities. But I'll say it's not fair because they have put women in a lot of pressure. They take us like we're not significant. Why we are significant?
Yeah, I agree to the way our society assigns roles to men and women. As you can see, we have top officials who are females in government departments. Even we have our ministers who are females.
Women in our country also, they don't have jobs because men, they occupy many jobs, even the government. The government forces what they did there. Majority is their men.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. A new study says shocking numbers of Ugandan school children are unable to comprehend basic reading and math, reflecting an alarming decline in the quality of education, mainly by government-run schools. Reporter Magume Davis-Rakarinj files this report.
The survey by the Twaweza NGO, which advocates for improvement of education in East Africa, was conducted a year ago to assess basic skills. Titled, Are Our Children Learning? It involved children ages 6 to 16. Lead researcher Meregoreti Nakabugo, who heads Uwezo Uganda, which conducted the study, says researchers interviewed more than 45,000 children in 32 districts. It found only 33% of children from primary 3 to 7 levels were able to read and comprehend a basic story at primary 2 level, compared with about 40% in a similar study conducted in 2015.
Most of them achieve that skill when they're in primary 6. I mean, having gone through 6 years of primary education. If you look at, for example, primary 5, you have only about 39% of children who are able to read and understand at primary 2 level, meaning that you still have about 60% who are seated in a primary 5 classroom, but actually they are not even yet at a primary 2 level.
The new study found that only 22% of students in government-owned schools had that reading competence, compared with 44% of those in private schools. Children study up to primary 7 in Uganda to complete their elementary level of education. Nakabugo says improper education at this level could affect performance in further education. She says higher teacher-student ratios is one main cause of poor education. The research also points at a lack of basic education infrastructure. For example, the ratio of people to toilet ratios stands at 1 to 58 as compared to the required 1 to 40. Over 50% of schools surveyed found they had bacteria-causing diseases in their drinking water. Mother of 9, Esther Kanabi, also blamed poverty. She says sometimes her children spend a day at school without a meal.
I cannot afford to buy the scholastic materials for those children. And food is also another problem. I cannot afford. They come back and ask, Mommy, give us food. Mommy, give us food. I tell them, today I've failed. Go and sleep. It is what I tell them. Sometimes they go on crying. Sometimes when I get some posho, I just make for them porridge and they come back and take that.
Tedros Turiagenda, Uganda's Director of Education Standards, says the government is well aware of the problem. The
report have really confirmed what we have seen before, which is good because that's a validation of other information that we've had. However, we did not sit down when we saw what had come out of these reports, and a number of interventions have already been put in place, especially to try and lift the literacy which this report was focusing on. And this literacy can only be lifted if it starts from the beginning.
The research recommended improvement of early education as one way to improve learning. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Zimbabwe's economic downturn continues to plunge more and more citizens into poverty, as a new assessment by an international organization reveals. Adi Gondo gives us more on the development.
International Labour Organization, ILO, Country Director Hopo Leng Pororo told a recent workshop in Bulawayo that poverty has reached alarming levels in Zimbabwe, with 65% of adults earning US$100 or less per month. The ILO workshop was designed to co-create design of workspace for informal economy traders. Pororo said the levels of informality in Africa are quite high, with Zimbabwe having one of the highest rates. Economic analysts, however, say the figure is actually lower than the ILO estimates. Economic analyst Dumisani Sibanda weighs in.
When they say $100, you would say it's an underestimation. When you look at the effective figure in terms of earning capacity, people are earning about $60.
Observers say those most impacted live in rural areas where there is very little economic activity due to the ongoing drought. Dumisani Nkomo of Upper Cook Trust, a Christian non-governmental organization with projects covering materiality, says poverty is hitting hard and deep.
The level of poverty in most of the areas that we're working, it is very, very acute. You find that in most of the areas, people have been affected by severe drought. They have to rely on handouts from non-governmental organizations, from the Department of Social Welfare. This has actually accentuated or deepened the levels of poverty in areas such as Madobo, Nkai, Vulilima, Mangwe, and most of Matabele North and South, where people depend on remittances from people that work in South Africa.
Ngomo says that the situation has changed for the worse for many families because of recent events.
But again, because of conditions in South Africa, where a lot of people are affected by xenophobia, also affected by the economic downturn globally, you find that there is increasing poverty, and the face of this poverty is the feminization of poverty, because you find that a lot of households, especially in Matabele South, are female headed. So this is what we have seen. There is extreme poverty.
While the whole country is dealing with efforts to stabilize currency chaos, Ngomo says his organization deals with people who have no access to either the RTGS dollar or to the US dollar. He says the issue of poverty is also affecting effective citizen participation in decision making.
Because people would rather choose to queue for food than to attend a public meeting on a pertinent social or public issue.
The government says it is working to improve people's lives and that one strategy is creating favorable conditions for the informal sector to thrive. Analysts, however, say informalizing the economy further is hardly the solution Zimbabwe needs. Instead, they call for efficient management of national resources and well-crafted macroeconomic policy. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo.
Nigeria became the world capital of open defecation in October after India, which once occupied the position before banning the practice. Nigerian authorities on Tuesday launched an open defecation free campaign as part of activities to mark World Toilet Day to advocate for clean toilets for all and end open defecation practice in Nigeria by 2025. Timothy Obiezu reports in Abuja.
Baba Awolu reports to work at 5 a.m. each day at a local toilet and washroom facility he owns in the Jahi district of Abuja. The facility, known in the native Hausa language as Kidanwanka, was built to serve poor people without access to bathrooms. Awolu says he has to arrive early so he can attend to users who are preparing for the day. What we're doing is helping people and the government. Instead of going to nearby bushes to defecate, they can use our facility and pay a token. According to the UNICEF study, Nigeria recently became the country with the most people practicing open defecation, passing India, which outlawed the practice. About 25% or more than 47 million Nigerians lack access to toilet facilities. The majority are in rural areas where many poor people can't afford to install toilets in their homes. The result is defecation in bushes and fields, leading to contaminated water supplies and the spread of disease. At an event in Abuja this week, Nigerian authorities said they are determined to end open defecation and achieve UN sanitation goals by 2025, 5 years ahead of schedule. Only 14 out of the 774 local government areas in Nigeria are open defecation free, authorities say. The practice is more prevalent in north central states, including Abuja, the capital. Muhammad Mahmoud is Nigeria's environment minister.
This commitment is demonstrated by Mr. President's declaration of state of emergency on water, sanitation and hygiene in the country. With just 11 years to go to the 2030 deadline, we must redouble our effort to provide universal access to toilet, leaving no one behind.
Some 87,000 young children in Nigeria die each year from illnesses linked to open defecation, poor sanitation and hygiene. That number may fall, however, as more places like Baba Awolu's open across Nigeria, giving people regular access to working bathrooms and a boost to public sanitation. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
And that's our show for this Wednesday. We leave you with the song Aklajar by Abdelaziz Amubarak.
أحلى جار يا أحلى جار عطرت كل الدنيا وانت مار عطرت كل الدنيا وانت مار وحد حرير خديك وحد مطار سلمينا لو بالعين أول شيار
We've been listening to Abdelaziz Amubarak with the song Aklajar. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
خطوه